Welcome back to the program. I have a friend who doesn't understand the value of travel. He thinks that the virtual world provides him all the insight he needs into new places and new experiences. I think nothing can be further from reality, and our guest today, Pico Iyer, is a living embodiment of that. For years, he's introduced us to his experiences of the world in his books The Lady and the Monk, The Global Soul, and The Open Road, among others. In his new book, The Man Within My Head, a kind of homage to Graham Greene, he shares with us his own internal journey of a life lived not behind a screen, but in the real world, interacting with real people and real experiences. It is my pleasure to welcome Pico Iyer back to this program to talk about The Man Within My Head. Pico Iyer, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure to be here again. Thank you, Jeff.
Great to have you here. One of the things I think that we all experience at some point is this notion of a feeling that we know somebody that we don't know, somebody that we've either never met or seen across a room or whatever it may be, this notion that there are certain people that just get inside of us. You have experienced that with respect to Graham Greene, and talk a little bit about it, because one of the things you talk about is that maybe it has something to do with your own upbringing and even your father in some respects.
Yes, and what I love about these connections is that they're so mysterious, they're inexplicable. Just as you say, it's as if you walk into a crowded room and you look across it and you see a stranger, and somehow you feel as if you know her better than you know your friends and family, and as if she knows you and your most intimate secrets. And I could give you a lot of reasons for why I feel a sense of kinship with Graham Greene. As you just said, I was born in middle-class England on the same road near which he had lived. I was born in the same hospital as his daughter. I went to the same school as his son, and I went through all those classic antiquated British boarding schools that he was a product of and that he described. And as you also said in your beautiful introduction, I've traveled a lot, from Saigon to Havana to Haiti to Paraguay, all the places that he's made famous. And yet, even if I gave you all those explanations, I wouldn't really believe it, because I think it's something more mysterious going on. The way that I notice sometimes I will dream a lot about Paris, which is a city I've almost never been to, and I'll never dream about the house in which I live or the cities where I've spent 5 or 10 years of my life. And there's no real accounting for this, but you're absolutely right, and I think especially in the virtual culture, many of us form these strong attachments to people we've never met in real life.
And I wonder if the virtual culture has anything to do with that. I mean, I couldn't help but thinking, as I was reading The Man Within My Head, you know, what would it have been like if Graham Greene could blog in his time, in real time? How would that be different? And one wonders how the virtual world plays a role in this.
That's wonderfully said. And I do feel that if Graham Greene had blogged, I would know everything about what he was thinking this moment, and yet I would lose the Graham Greene that I cherish. I often think that Shakespeare is one of the most compelling people in history, precisely because we don't have his diaries, and really we know almost nothing about who he was, and that's how he hovers so potently inside our heads, the way that maybe Paris Hilton doesn't. But you're right, because I was alive at the same time. Graham Greene died in 1991, and because I already loved his work so much, I made a conscious effort not to meet him, because I felt that if I met him, I would hear his voice, I would see his face, I would have some kind of souvenir of an encounter, but somehow that would dilute and simplify what is a much deeper connection between his soul speaking in his books and mine. And I know a lot of people have the same kind of connection with music. I have friends who will listen to a Joni Mitchell record and feel as if she's stolen their diary and released their secrets to the world, and that she is almost like their secret soul. And It's interesting how that works. But I think blogging and tweeting and some of that actually brings all this up to the surface and in fact compromises its power.
And in some ways, and maybe this isn't the most eloquent way to state it, but there is a certain knowledge that comes from that which we don't understand, that in mystery there is a certain understanding that we have, or at least understand the right questions to ask about something, someone, or someplace.
I love that, what you just said. I think mystery is the theme of this book, and I think Graham Greene felt very much that the most important things in life, whether it's falling in love or having faith or running into these coincidences and convergences are exactly the things you can't explain. If you can explain something, it means that you're in control of it or you're bigger than it. But there's so many things that are much bigger than us, and their beauty is in exactly their mystery.
And you talk about that with respect to Graham Greene with regards to Vietnam and his main character in The Quiet American and the inability for anybody really to get inside that and understand it.
Yes, and I think also as a writer and as somebody who studied under a Jungian dream analyst when he was 16 years old, he had a very keen sense of how the subconscious is in some ways in tune with the future as much as in the past. It's mysterious also. And one of the things about The Quiet American is that Graham Greene wrote it in Saigon in the early 1950s, and if you were to go to Saigon tomorrow, that would be the best guidebook. And if you were to think about what is going on in Afghanistan right now or what happened in Iraq a few years ago, I think the ideal book to read about that would be Graham Greene's book about Vietnam from 60 years ago. And somehow he had the kind of eye, which I guess is every writer's dream, whereby even as he was annotating the details of the world immediately around him, it was almost as if he was a fortune teller looking into the future.
And it's one of the things that is arguably harmful or difficult about the real-time kind of virtual world that we all sometimes operate in today is that it doesn't bring with it a sense of context or, more importantly, a sense of history. And that without that sense of history and mystery in some cases, it's impossible to understand where we really are today.
It's so, so wonderfully said. And I think that is exactly why I love reading and writing, because I think more and more we have these wonderful multimedia devices all around us that give us the world with great immediacy and power. But there's something that writing can do in terms of taking us into the world of nuance and silence and the spaces between the words, and in some ways, as you said, to give us a larger picture, to give us a context, to give us a sense of the inexplicable that many other devices can't. And that's why I think it still serves an important function in our dream lives and in our subconscious.
Talk about that silence, because I know that's something that you've thought a lot about, written a lot about, and how to, in some ways, stay modern within the world and yet not be overtaken by it.
I think we can only make sense of the world by stepping out of it for a while. That the world is ever more accelerated. It gives us wonderful attractions and diversions and information. But we can only see how to make the best use of that information by unplugging and turning it off. For example, in terms of the online world, which has expanded our universe, the only way we can do justice to the online world is going offline and summoning the kind of clarity and wisdom and sense of perspective and a larger picture that will allow us to go online again and really see how to navigate it clearly and with direction instead of just sinking under a sea of information. Because what strikes me is that in only a few years, maybe 10 or 15 years, many of us feel as if we've gone from having too little information about the world to having too much, and we're almost dizzy at this kind of post-human speed where, you know, the cell phone is ringing and emails are coming in and we have the whole Library of Alexandria in our bedroom, and yet we feel totally lost and we don't know how to get from A to B. So I think many of us are ODing on information.
The other aspect of it is that it allows us, it sort of defeats the idea of travel in some respects, because what it does is it brings with us, wherever we go, the world that we're comfortable with, and it kind of reaffirms that and doesn't allow us to really fully have the experience that travel is intended to provide.
Yes, exactly. I think the beauty of travel usually comes when we get lost or when we're confounded. And online we can get images and information and everything about being in Morocco except that sensation of stumbling through the back streets of Morocco lost as the darkness is falling and being taken into some unsettling but powerful part of ourselves.
Talk about why you think that's important. You know, it's funny because I mentioned in the introduction an argument that I have all the time with a friend of mine who thinks that traveling in the virtual world or going online and learning everything about Morocco or anywhere else is enough. He doesn't want to travel. Talk about why that's so important.
I find that when I'm at home, I think I know everything about the world. And in some ways I'm encircled by my assumptions and prejudices. I feel I'm on top of the world. I feel I can tell you what's going to happen tomorrow. But as soon as I'm on the back streets of Morocco, I'm humbled, and I realize I don't know a thing about the world, and that I'm at the mercy of much larger forces, whether you think they're religious or just nature or providence or time. And I think that's very healthy. It reminds us of our ignorance, and it reminds us of the great darkness around us that we can't hope to fathom. I think it puts us in place.
It also revitalizes us in pretty unique ways. It gives us a sense of kind of rebirth going to someplace exotic in particular.
Yes, and somewhere shocking in particular often, but exactly so. It slaps you awake in some ways. And I often feel as if I'm sleepwalking through my life at home, because to some extent every day is somewhat similar, and I could go through it even if I'm only functioning at 10%. But put me in the streets of India or Haiti tomorrow, and it's as if all my senses are pushed onto the setting marked on. I'm wide awake. I'm taken back, as you said, to a kind of childlike state of wonder and excitement and sometimes terror. And I think it's important to be reminded of the world and its immediacy that way.
You talk about the fact that you take Graham Greene with you, the Quiet American in particular, as kind of a private Bible of sorts. Talk about how that has served you in some of these places.
Well, for the listeners who don't know the book, it's set in Saigon in 1951, and it's about a young American who comes in determined to reform this ancient culture in the light of America and in the light of what he's just learned at Harvard. And he's a very engaging person, but he perhaps doesn't know enough about his own ignorance. And so it's a good reminder to me when I go to a foreign country not to pretend to know it all. And it sometimes seems to correspond to what we see playing out in the world again and again. And his foil, the other main character in the book, is an Englishman who claims not to have any feelings and not to have any opinions and not to care about anything. He's a sort of classic European, and I think anyone who travels meets that kind of person too. On the one hand, the American is sometimes too innocent. On the other hand, the European is often too jaded. And it's wonderful how these patterns just keep on playing out again and again. And so somebody who really gets them, as Graham Greene did in The Quiet American, is anticipating what you or I might see on the streets of Beirut tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, all of this provides what we were discussing before, this sense of context and history. If one goes back and rereads The Quiet American, you kind of understand what happened in Vietnam after that.
Yes, in the early 1950s, Graham Greene was writing about napalm bombing and CIA intrigue and the U.S. trying to find a proxy Vietnamese group to ally itself with. He was describing in 1952 things that were happening in 1965. And I probably wouldn't necessarily tell your listeners to read my book, Man Within My Head, but just as you were saying, I would strongly recommend they read Graham Greene's book, The Quiet American, because it does tell us a lot about what was going to happen and what still happens.
Talk about your decision to write this book, something obviously you've been thinking about for a long time.
Partly it was an inner journey, as you can tell, and as you said in your introduction, I've made a lot of external journeys, and I've traveled the world from North Korea to Ethiopia to Yemen to many other places, and I've really enjoyed that. But I think it's also important first to know the world, but also to know yourself. And somehow, when I read Graham Greene, I feel as if I can see all the parts of myself I'd rather not look at. And it's very hard for any of us to look at ourselves, honestly. But sometimes we see an echo or a reflection or a kind of cracked mirror version of ourselves. And suddenly we can actually look at it and take stock of it. And I feel I can do that a lot with Graham Greene.
And, of course, one of the things you have in common that you talk about is this experience with an English boarding school, which you say really prepares anyone for wanting to travel to the far corners of the globe.
Yes. I mean, I think it's no coincidence that to this day many of the great travel writers we enjoy are all products of those all-boys English schools. And one of the ways they prepare you for the world is that the food is so horrible, the conditions are so spartan, it's almost a training for a rigorous military life, that when you end up in the caves of Afghanistan with nothing to eat and shivering in the cold, you're pretty much back in school again, and you're well prepared for that.
Talk about the experience, for you at least, of coming home. When you've done this traveling and you return home to Santa Barbara or Japan, what is that like, coming back home again?
Well, I like the stillness in life, because it's only when you're in stillness that you can make sense of all the movement. It's like what we were saying a few minutes before. And I walk around the world, sometimes for months and end, taking in sights and sounds and impressions, and then I have to step back to Santa Barbara or Japan and sit very still for sometimes months on end to make sense of it and sift through it in my mind. I also, every time I return home, I tell myself, now I'm back in my mother's home in Santa Barbara, I'm going to look at the world with the same eyes of freshness that I just brought to Tibet or Saigon. And unfortunately, that lasts for about 3 days, and then I'm back in my own habits. But I always like imagining my hometown in California, say, through the eyes of somebody who's just arrived from Tibet or Bolivia or Cuba, and therefore often being reminded of its beauties, which sometimes I can forget.
Right. Is that hard to do, to put yourself in that place, in that position?
It's very hard to do, but I think it's very worthwhile and almost necessary to do. And I remember a few years ago I was traveling across Tibet, and I came back to my mother's house in Santa Barbara, and I was jet-lagged and disappointed to be outside Tibet and couldn't settle to anything. And I just got in my car, and I drove 10 minutes up the road from her home in the hills of Santa Barbara, and I looked around me, and there were just miles upon miles of unvisited valleys and the great blue expanse of the ocean on one side and a lake in the middle. And suddenly I realized what I was seeing outside Santa Barbara, California, was just as beautiful as anything I'd seen in Tibet. All that was required was the eyes to see it with, and I was able to see it then, but so often I forget to look at it in that way.
When you are back at home, to what extent do you use virtual opportunities in the virtual world to travel or to look at new places?
Well, I think I'm a bit of an old fogey in that regard. I've got to confess, I've never been on Facebook. I used the internet very little until recently. I had a dial-up connection, and I think I'm one of those people who still hunger for, as you said in your introduction, first-person encounter with the world. And there's something about just seeing somebody's face and hearing their voice and hearing all the things that are not said that brings the world much more powerfully to me home than just getting it online. It's like the difference between being with your partner or spouse in the same room and communicating with them through Skype. Skype is better than nothing, but it's no substitute for the real contact.
Right. One wonders, though, and I think about this a lot, whether or not it's a zero-sum game. In other words, is one mutually exclusive of the other? Can you enjoy the benefits of all that and still appreciate all the things that we talked about earlier?
Yes, I think we're very lucky that we do have that choice and we do have all these alternatives. And I'm lucky I get to travel, but for the many who don't have the time or resources to travel, the virtual world is amazing and it's brought the universe right into our homes. I think the only challenge is that we have to find a balance with it. And it's not that I distrust technology, I just distrust myself to make the best use of it. But as long as we can do that, as you say, it's wonderful to see Cuba at home, and it's wonderful nowadays we have the chance to see Cuba in person also.
And it's very funny that there are places now, resorts, that promote themselves as being kind of Wi-Fi free so that you can go there and not be connected.
There's a hotel not far from where I'm standing here in San Francisco that charges $2,265 a night for a room, one of whose great adornments is, as you say, no TV. And my friends who follow trends in travel say that these black hole resorts are very much a thing of the future, the great fashion of the coming moment, that the big luxury now is to be free of your cell phone and free of your email for at least a few hours or a few days.
Well, I'm sure you may have used it for all I know, but there are writers that use this freedom software that forces you to be disconnected.
Yes, it's amazing how quickly we've gone from throwing our arms excitedly around technology or computer technology to taking these measures to run away from it. And I think there are 5 or 6 different software programs. One of them is called Freedom, that writers will pay for to disable the same internet connections that they found so liberating maybe just 5 years ago.
Pico Iyer, his new book is The Man Within My Head. Pico, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. I always have a great time with you.
Thank you.
Jeff.